This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Picture the North Pole and the Arctic regions around it, and what do you see, right? Ice, permafrost, maybe a few polar bears. But the picture of the Arctic is changing, in some cases dramatically, with scientists reporting thinning ice, permafrost that isn't permanent, and summers that seem to be gradually getting longer. Researchers met this week in Seattle at an unusual meeting to talk about how changes in the Arctic are related to each other, changes affecting the sea, air, and land in the Arctic regions, and about what information is needed to really piece together how the Arctic ecosystem works. This hour, we'll be talking about conditions in the Arctic, what's going on with the ice there, and how that affects other parts of the ecosystem, like the plants, animals, fish, and people who live in Alaska, Canada, Iceland, Scandinavia, and other Arctic regions. And if you'd like to join us, you're more than welcome. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can surf over to our website at Science Friday for more information. Let me introduce my guests. James Morrison is a principal oceanographer at the Polar Science Center and director of SEARCH, the Study of Environmental Arctic Change Project Office, based in the Applied Physics Lab at the University of Washington. And he joins us from Seattle on member station KUOW. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
Thank you. Seymour Laxon is a senior lecturer in the Department of Space and Climate Physics at the University College London in the UK. He's also author of a paper in this week's Nature on the connection between length of the seasons and the thinning of ice in the Arctic. He joins us by phone from London. Good evening to you.
Oh, hi. Good evening.
Yeah, good evening. Mark Serez is a research scientist at the Cooperative Institute for Research in the Environmental Sciences and the National Snow and Ice Data Center that's based at the University of Colorado in Boulder. He joins us by phone from his office. Welcome.
My pleasure to be here.
Let me begin with you. Can you give us an idea of how has the ice situation changed over the years?
Well, it really has changed quite dramatically. Since about 1978, anyhow, we've been able to get a very clean picture, I think, of what's happening to the sea ice cover. And this is from satellites, polar orbiting satellites. And what we find is since 1978, the sea ice cover has declined by about 3% per decade. That's a pretty big number. And it turns out that last year, the summer of 2002, we reached the lowest levels of ice that we've recorded in the satellite era. So at least since 1978, but we're pretty sure that this is the lowest we've seen probably in at last the past 50 years. So we had been tracking what's happening on the sea ice for this year. The question is, would it recover? And in fact, it did not. We just barely missed setting another new record this year. So this sea ice decline is really one of the most prominent and remarkable things that I've seen in the Arctic, and this downward trend is certainly continuing.
So it's gone. Give us an idea of how much, in feet or meters, how much that decline means.
Oh, I think we put the number in. It's something, the recent decline is something like the areas of Colorado and New Hampshire combined, something like that. It's a pretty darn big area.
Wow. Wow. Is it that the area is shrinking, or the ice is getting thinner?
Well, it appears to be both. The ice area is shrinking. That is the area of the ice cover, say in square meters, that's covered with ice. That's certainly shrinking. There's also quite a bit of evidence that the ice cover is also thinning, becoming thinner. So, you know, we're losing area, we're losing thickness of the ice, so the whole ice volume seems to be declining. Mm-hmm. With regard to this thinning thing, there's a lot of arguments about what's really happening. Are we really seeing thinning from more melt? Or are we, for example, redistributing some of the ice from one part of the Arctic to another where we really can't see it? Most of this information we get on the ice thickness comes from submarine sonar data. These are submarines that travel under the ice, have an upward-looking sonar, and they can get a good estimate of what the ice thickness is. There's been a lot of controversy of just what the patterns have been, how much of the thinning has occurred, but the numbers seem to be pretty clean, I think, that at least in the last decade, there has been some very significant thinning of the ice cover.
Mm-hmm. Jamie Morrison, you just finished a conference there in Seattle this week on the changes in the Arctic. Why this conference? Are there alarm signals going off?
Well, I guess you would say there are alarm signals going off. The We began to notice, as well, Mark indicated, we started to notice changes beginning in the late 70s. We really noticed a change in many characteristics of the Arctic beginning in the early 1990s. And for me, I'm an oceanographer, and my first recognition of some of these changes were changes in the circulation pattern of the Arctic Ocean and the distribution of saltier Atlantic-derived water versus fresher Pacific-derived waters. And we, as a few of us began to see changes in the atmosphere and in the ocean, we started to have occasional conferences to just explore how many other fields had these. And lo and behold, we found that, well, the people looking at ice were seeing a thinning of the ice, change in the ice extent, as Mark was talking about. When we started looking at things that people working on land were looking at, we saw that the permafrost experts were seeing thawing in the intermittent permafrost regions of Alaska and in large areas of the Siberian Arctic. And the native populations, in their hunting and just traveling around, started to notice changes that, and they noticed these with quite a bit of alarm. They found they couldn't hunt at the usual times or find the same species they were used to seeing. And what we began to recognize starting in about 1999 was that this all had occurred at about the same time as a marked decrease in the atmospheric pressure over the Arctic region that seemed to be related to a general pattern of atmospheric circulation change for the whole northern hemisphere. So when we started to see all these connections, we began to feel that we were really watching something major evolve that linked the Arctic with the rest of the global climate. And this meeting really was to try and, well, push this study of environmental Arctic change into an implementation phase in which we would set out the kinds of multidisciplinary observations we'd need to understand how this whole thing is going to evolve.
So we don't know what the exact cause is, whether they're short-term, whether they're climate change, whether they're oscillations like we might have an El Nino or something in down south, and there might be temporary changes. You know, not ready to say that yet.
No, I think we've... well, it's interesting you mention El Nino because we found ourselves trying to characterize this event that has so many dimensions, and with some long-winded explanation like a complex of change occurring over large scales in the Arctic over at least decadal scales. And, of course, we got tired of using that long-winded explanation, and so we chose a Yupik Eskimo word to give a name to it, similar to describing the ENSO phenomenon as El Nino. And the name is Unami, so that's a Yupik Eskimo word for tomorrow.
Unami.
So we'll
a word has entered our vocabulary now.
I certainly hope so. It's certainly entered mine.
Dr. Laxon, you wrote a paper about polar bears now being, their habitat being threatened by this thinning of the Arctic sea ice.
Oh, well, the subject of the paper is not so much polar bears as the observations of ice thickness that we've been doing. Mm-hmm. I'm not an expert on polar bears. All I've learned in the last few days from some experts that I've been talking to is the fact that, first of all, the ice in Hudson Bay is coming back later and later each summer, so the bears are getting actually less heavy. They're getting more hungry during the summer, and there's also lower survivability amongst cubs, really.
Mm-hmm. So you're not ready to say that, you know, the polar bears who live on the ice might
well,
be.
The subject of my paper is more the link between the thickness of the ice and the you know, and the length of summer, really.
Right.
Talking to other people, you know, there's some debate about what might happen if the ice disappears completely. You know, what effect that will have on the bears. Some of them may head south through Canada and eat other things other than the seals that they currently eat when they're traveling over the ice. But my colleagues may know better than me the ultimate fate of the bears.
Well, let's talk about then what you know most about, and that is the summer season, thinning the ice. How much longer is the season now than it used to be?
Well, this really comes from a work of my co-author who published his work actually a little while ago. He found an increase in the summer length, the melt season length, of around about a fortnight over the last 25 years, or 20 years actually, his data record was. And it's very nice that the more recent work by my NASA colleagues, Joey Camizo and others, has really confirmed that signal, and also shown a corresponding increase in the rise of temperatures during the same period.
I asked Dr. Morrison this question. Let me ask you other two gentlemen. Do you think it has anything to do with global warming, or is it too early to tell?
Well, I can try and handle that a bit. This is Mark Serez here. Of course, anyone who probably listens to NPR is well aware of the problem of global warming or the global warming issue. And if we look over the globe, it seems that since the beginning of the last century, or beginning of the 20th century, the global climate has warmed by roughly a degree Fahrenheit. Doesn't really sound like a big amount, but we're talking about averaging temperatures all over the globe. And in that sense, yes, it is large. And what we've seen is that this general upward trend has really started to accelerate in about the past 30 years, and where we've seen some of the biggest changes are in the Arctic. And if we look at what we know from climate models and from theory, the temperature changes in the Arctic under a sort of a global warming scenario, this is where we ought to see the changes first and where they ought to be the most pronounced. Now, the problem here is that as attribution is not really all that easy, because at the same time, in the past, you know, 20 or 30 years, we've seen this change in the atmospheric circulation. We've seen a change that tends to pump more warm air up into the Arctic region. This is associated with something called the Arctic Oscillation, which probably some of you have heard about. And so some of the thinking is, well, you know, how can we attribute this to something like a global warming signal? Because we've just seen a change in the atmospheric circulation. These things happen. The atmosphere does change. But what we're starting to recognize now is that this change in the atmospheric circulation, this Arctic oscillation, is just the sort of thing that we might expect under a general global warming scenario. In other words, for example, if we load the atmosphere with greenhouse gases, we change the structure of the atmosphere such that this warm Arctic oscillation pattern becomes more favorable or becomes more common.
So you're not, do you call it an tsunami like your colleague does? Give it a name?
I was a bit, initially a bit averse about this tsunami phrase, but it kind of grows on you after a while.
All right. We're going to have to grow into a break here, so stay with us. We're going to take a short break, come back, and talk lots more about the melting of the Arctic here. And take your calls, 1-800-989-8255, if you'd like to talk about what's going on in the Arctic Circle. So stay with us. Maybe you live there. Maybe you can call us from the Arctic Circle. We'll see. Don't go away. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the Arctic and the melting that is going on there with my guest James Morrison of the University of Washington, Seymour Laxon University College London, UK, and Mark Serez of the University of Colorado in Boulder. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if people are calling in from out there in the Arctic. Let's try Casey in Fairbanks. Hi, Casey. Hey there. Not quite the Arctic, are you?
Pretty close.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sort of trapped at home today. It's raining outside. Kind of abnormal thing. Last year was the first time that I ever noticed freezing rain. Usually this time of year we've got a pretty good cover of snow by Halloween. I was born and raised here, and I remember being a little kid trick-or-treating out in the cold and, you know, having plenty of snow to play around in. And today we're sort of locked down with this freezing rain that's going on.
That shouldn't be raining. It should be snowing is what you're saying.
Definitely, yeah.
My guests want to react to that? Mark Serez?
I guess I'm not really surprised. Now, of course, it's from the science viewpoint, it's hard to ascribe, say, a single event or even what happens in a single year to a global warming thing. But I know these changes in Fairbanks are, part of a larger picture. In Alaska is one of the regions where we have seen some of these very pronounced changes. And, of course, in a global warming scenario in the Arctic, one of the things we're going to start to see is that less of the precipitation falls as snow, more of it falls as rain. So another thing we ought to be seeing at some point is the idea, anyhow, is that precipitation itself is going to increase. What happens is if the Arctic warms, that means that the Arctic atmosphere can hold more water vapor. More water vapor means more precipitation. So changes in precipitation, or the hydrologic cycle in general, is one of the things we're really keeping a close eye on.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks.
1-800-989-8255. Of course, we saw in the news just recently this giant ice shelf that calved off in the Arctic that actually held back some fresh water, and it had created a unique freshwater lake, and now it no longer exists. Evidence of that warming?
Again, it's a little hard to say. This is one event. Now, this Wartime ice shelf was a real interesting thing. I remember I was on it, actually, in 1983, quite some time ago. Now, in terms of the climate effects of, say, something like this ice shelf breaking up, the climate effects of that are trivial. Okay, this is not influencing climate in any way. But I see it as just another piece of the puzzle. It's another thing that really fits into this larger picture of Arctic climate change that we've seen. We've seen this reduction in the sea ice. We've seen this pattern of warming. Now we see that the Wartime ice shelf, one of the last vestige ice shelves that existed in the Arctic, has broken up. So it's never going to come back either.
Dr. Marson, what do you need to convince you that it is not, it's more than an unami, something that is a seasonal fluctuation or over many years instead of a true climate change from global warming? What kind of evidence do you need?
Well, I think the problem that always exists with ascribing things to greenhouse gas warming or long-term climate change is just that. It's the length of the record. And this Arctic oscillation that Mark mentioned shows variation or energy at all kinds of timescales, from daily up to as long as we have records. And it's energetic at all those scales. The event that popped out in the early 90s has since relaxed, not quite to the pre-1990 level, but definitely has decreased. So I want to be careful to say that event probably is not climate change. It is more just decadal variability, and it's substantial. So it's a little, it's difficult or impossible to separate that out. And at the same time, one can easily imagine that as some of these greenhouse gas scenarios, modeling results suggest, there would be a long-term rising trend in the Arctic Oscillation Index, and superimposed on that is variability. And maybe in a different climate state, the variability is greater. So at any one time, it's very difficult to tell. And in one sense, for the residents of the North, for the fellow in Fairbanks, for me here in Seattle, which, by the way, is predicting snow for this weekend. In a way, it doesn't matter. We still are subject to these changes, and the only way to give us some predictive capability is to study them some more. So I think it's definitely possible that this long-term trend in the AO index is related to climate change. I think it's nailing that down that just takes a long record.
1-800-989-8255. So it's going to be in hindsight then, when we look at it?
Yeah, I think it probably will be in the end. That's not to say that we shouldn't take these as cautionary messages from nature and act accordingly. But you'll always find people, for example, at our conference that disagree on the significance of these things in terms of global warming.
Seymour Laxon, do you agree? Is it?
Yeah, I agree. I agree entirely with Jamie's view. I think that I view this whole question really more as a balance of evidence. I mean, I was asked on live TV about whether is this global warming or isn't it? And it's not a question that's possible to answer yet. But I think it's a question of the balance of evidence. And I would say that, along with my colleagues and the recent reports by NASA, that at the moment the balance of evidence is pointing in one direction. And that's all we can say for now. But saying yes it is or no it isn't is not really a scientific way of looking at the problem, I would say.
How useful has the satellite images been to keeping track of all the ice? You see some really incredible images coming from that I guess you never had years ago.
Well, that's right. Yeah, that's right. I mean, my own work, as Mark said, we've seen an astonishing decline in the aerial coverage of the ice over the last 20, 30 years. And I think that the what we've added with the paper published just yesterday is actually being able to measure the thickness of the ice for the first time. I think what we see from that, well, there's two things that we see. One is the idea that the older submarine results would show this thinning in the central Arctic, and it had been argued that the ice had sort of been blown elsewhere where the submarine data remained classified. In fact, we're seeing thinner ice in those areas as well with the satellite, because of course we can cover the whole Arctic and we can do it winter in and winter out. So there was also disagreement between some of the computer models that are showing these predictions, although they have a consensus actually in showing a large degree of thinning during the 1990s.
Where does that submarine data come from?
Oh, this is data that's been released by declassified by both the U.S. and British navies, mainly the U.S. Navy actually. I think it was an initiative started off by Al Gore in the beginning, many years ago.
Mm-hmm. Let me go to the phones. Sarah in Oakland, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hi. My question was, first I wanted to applaud your guests for sort of making these connections that they're making between their different fields of research and looking at bigger patterns. And my question is, how if any, in any way, you're looking in terms of advocacy? Because it sounds like to me, actually, there is a ton of very sort of intense evidence saying a lot of really unusual things are happening. Obviously we're heating up, and it does fit with the model of climate change. Is there any move towards advocacy on a governmental level, or looking at sort of using the precautionary principle in terms of looking at how, maybe we can't say, okay, this is all attributed to climate change, but at what point do we say, look, we've got to do something, if it is.
Mark Serres? Are you ready to speak up about something?
Yeah, at least within we call it the level of the science community in terms of the government funding, okay, there's a strong recognition of this and very strong support for the research. For example, myself, I'm a soft money scientist. Most of my money comes from the National Science Foundation to look at these issues. In terms of looking at these Arctic climate issues, NASA is on board. NOAA is on board. So in terms of the broader science community and the sort of government funding agencies that are interested in climate, we have very strong support. And of course, we have to remember that as the scientists, we have a responsibility to the public. You know, basically, we work on your tax money, okay? And I think one of the best things that we can do in terms of the science community, first and foremost, is to get the word out, is to go to the public and explain what we think is happening, as we're doing here today. Now, what's happening at higher government levels, in terms of, say, you know, the Bush administration, of course, you know, it's I certainly don't agree with the views on with the sort of views they're taking, but all we can do, or I can do, is just keep trying to pound the message home that changes are occurring in the Arctic. This is something we ought to be concerned about.
Jamie Morrison, would you agree?
Well, pretty much. I guess I feel a responsibility as a scientist, and to try and sort of separate my my feelings about policy and politics that I have as personally or as a citizen from my research. And I guess I feel it's our responsibility to let the public know what we think is going on, but I feel that it's a difficult situation, especially with regard to global warming and so forth, which is a politically complicated thing. I think it's important that no matter what administration is in power and who I'm talking to, that I make them feel confident that I'm going to just try and do a good job of explaining the scientific facts as I see them and the theories about what I think will happen, rather than looking like I have some axe to grind in one particular policy direction or another.
Right. But currently there seems to be less receptivity in this administration in terms of, I mean, it seems like they're listening to some scientists and not to others, essentially.
I guess I've been, I have, you know, we may have issues with this administration and any other administration on some things. I have to say I've been really impressed with this administration's interest in establishing an Earth observing system. And whatever the motivation, I think it's a very good idea.
Well, the president has repeated, and his spokespeople have always repeated, we need to study it more.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all the time, you know, well, you know, the Kyoto Treaty, no, we need to study it more. Some people will view that as politics. Other people view that as pork, you know. Hey, we got more money to do research. Let's not rock that boat.
And others will view it as a great idea. Let's have a better observing system, because that's, I am showing a bias in that I feel that that's exactly what we need to do. There's a danger, just as all these changes are occurring in the Arctic, that we're also finding a lot of the observing systems that told us what was going on in the past are disappearing. Now, Seymour's paper is a good example of improvements. We can do better with satellites, and those will be more and more important. But, for example, in the 50s through the 1980s, the Soviet Union conducted regular surveys of oceanographic conditions all over the Arctic. Well, those have stopped. As part of the end of the Cold War, we were able to make science-dedicated submarine cruises, but all those submarines have joined the scrap heap, and those cruises have stopped. And so now we find, paradoxically, just as all these changes are occurring, our ability to go out and measure in the ocean has decreased. And that's why we're interested in reinvigorating those with the study of environmental Arctic change, and why the concept of an Earth observing system makes a lot of sense to me.
So, thanks for calling, Sarah.
Okay.
1-800-989-8255 is the number. We're talking about the Arctic and what's going on with the cold weather up there on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You know, with the forest fires out in California, there now has been renewed talks of increasing the research budget about for fires and you know, detection and whatever that was about to be cut off in Congress. And now there's renewed, hey, we need this stuff, you know. Maybe you need something with the ice melting closer to Washington.
Well,
for that to happen.
Excuse me, no, but interestingly, ahead. The... one of the aspects of UNAMI has been a drying of the Alaska taiga forests and forest in general, I guess, in Alaska, and an increase in fire frequency. So I guess if I'm really pushing my search banner, I'd have to say, well, maybe we're related to the fires down in Southern California.
Yeah, that's right. People usually don't think of forest fires in the Arctic, but they do happen, and evidence is that the frequency does appear to be increasing, and it's not quite clear why.
I'd just like to go back to something that Jamie said about satellites and the surface observations. I think he really hit the nail on the head there, because it's very important people don't get the impression that we can do everything from satellites these days, and that nobody knows needs to go to the Arctic. And you know, people hear headlines about hear news about people being able to read headlines from space. It's really very complicated, and what we need is really an integrated system, because there's some things we can do from satellites, but there's some things we can only do by going there. And in particular, well, in my case, Jamie talked about the submarines. Now, the submarines were data in the 90s was absolutely critical for persuading people that we could do this from space. And in the future, we have a number of missions coming up. One next year, a new European mission to map the ice, and it's proving very difficult to find the resources to be able to validate the measurements that we're making. So I kind of concur wholeheartedly with Jamie's view. We need an integrated observation system. You can't do everything from satellites, even though that's my job, if you like.
That's very well spoken. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more with our guest, Jamie Morrison at the University of Washington, Seymour Laxon, University College London in the UK, and Mark Serez, University of Colorado in Boulder. And we're going to talk about a little bit about the politics of global warming and how it looks like it's local politics now. As the Congress and the President shy away from writing legislation that will cap carbon emissions, so states are taking it on themselves. We'll talk about that in a little bit after this short break. Stay with us. Don't go away. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.